This is Ozarks at Large. With me on the phone from his office in Fort Smith is Michael Tilley with Talk Business and Politics. Michael, how are you doing on this Friday?
I'm doing well.
Happy Valentine's Day, by the way.
I guess I need to get that going. Yeah. Thanks for the reminder.
You know what's going is Mercy Fort Smith and a rehab hospital. They had a groundbreaking, I think it was Tuesday.
Yes. Yep. Kind of a little muddy groundbreaking out there, but it didn't stop. And they had several folks out there. And what they're working on, of course, they've been working on it for a little bit, but it's almost a 53,000 square foot rehab hospital, 40 bed hospital, about $21 million. And it is right next. I mean, it is adjacent to the Arkansas Colleges of Health Education. I mean, the driveway separates them. And so, obviously, this is another partnership that Mercy has. Mercy has a clinic across the street from the college. So this is another operation in which the students in the school there, especially on the occupational therapy, on the occupational therapy and school of physical therapy, those students, I mean, what a perfect training ground, literally across the street. So that's an interesting positive for that development. And Kindred Healthcare is doing this for Mercy. This is the fourth rehab hospital they do. They've got Oklahoma City, St. Louis, and Springfield, and this will be the fourth. Fort Smith will be the fourth. But just another, medical facility going up out there. I don't think this will be the last. That's becoming, I encourage anyone that's not driven out there in the last year to drive out there and see what all was just built. That's becoming its own little medical community out there around that college.
Didn't Arkansas Colleges of Health and of Health Education donate the land for this rehab hospital?
Yes, sir. Yeah, that's a good point. They donate. I mean, they're. I think Kyle Parker said something to the effect of, if you want to talk economic development, this is the best way to promote it. So yeah, they donated a good chunk of acreage out there. Of course, as I said earlier, it's in there. It wasn't just totally altruistic move. They'll benefit from it also. I mean, can you imagine recruiting students? And one of your key recruiting tools is not only can we provide, quality education, but you're going to get a real life education across the road. So they'll be doing that. And to that point, that sector of the economy for the Fort Smith regional economy is starting to grow. There was roughly 17,400 jobs in that sector in December, which was a new record. There's been a little over 10 or a little just right at 10% job growth in that sector in the past decade. So if there's a sector maybe that can help the region recover from the loss of manufacturing jobs, maybe this is it.
Do you think that growth helped home sales in the Fort Smith Metro in 2019 nudge up by 3%?
You are definitely king of the segues. Yes, I think that. I know you're kidding, but that has to be a factor, bringing in several hundred folks, maybe more than 1,000 over the past 2 or 3 years. But yeah, in 2009 in the Fort Smith Metro, there's 3,406 homes sold. That's up 2.8%, and the value of those homes sold in the metro area was up 8%, thanks to data provided to us generously from Ashley Milton. She's an executive broker with Chuck Fawcett Realty here in Fort Smith. But good numbers. I was somewhat surprised. The last 2 years there have been increases. 17 was up, 18 was up. So the trend is on the upside. The average sales price of the home sold in the region was a little over $150,000. So, and the days on market fell, which is the good direction. Days on market in the region was 102 the average days. That was down from 108 in 2018. So another good sign. I think we've had a cut between building permits and tourism numbers. We've had some good little bright spots for the Fort Smith regional economy in the last few months.
And when we ended our conversation last week, we discussed the ongoing saga of what is Fort Smith sewers and maintenance. And you were a little bit upset with what you saw as the city not being completely transparent. What's the latest on that following our conversation last week?
Right. Well, it's frustrating with the city not being transparent, and they're still not transparent. But however, On the water issue side, you know, Fort Smith had been plagued. Again, the city had for so many years, and it's not the fault of this current board or the current city leadership, but so many years the city had been negligent in providing adequate maintenance, repairs, upkeep, whatever you want to call it, for the water and sewer system. And so about 9 months ago, the city had over 700 water leaks around the city, and it had been having that many for a while. And no matter how much time and how much money and personnel they put into it, they just couldn't catch up. The leaks, the number of leaks, just, you know, as they, it's almost like they'd fix two leaks and three would show up. So the city board authorized a little over $350,000 worth of additional equipment, authorized 10 new positions to be filled to help. And now that number is down to 212 leaks to be repaired. And it's really probably fewer than that, because there are some of those leaks where they fixed it, but they just haven't completely done the restoration on the site. So they've made huge leaps. So Lance McAvoy, who's director of utilities in the city of Fort Smith, he and his staff are to be commended on taking what had been a perennial problem, taking some extra resources and really knocking a big hole in it. Now his goal is, if they get the backlog fixed, then turn that money and those resources and those people to what he calls a proactive system of preventative maintenance, where they're doing valve replacements, they're doing meter replacements, they're flushing lines. And McAvoy's, now this is his, these are his numbers. We haven't looked to verify them or looked to see what the national or state trends are. But he says for every dollar you spend being proactive, you save $4 on the other end being reactive, in terms of having to go out and fix leaks and that kind of thing. So kudos to the city for recognizing there was a problem, stepping up, putting some resources to it, and fixing it.
I mean, when you think that a city has been getting water to and from homes for more than a century, it's pretty amazing, because that's a 24/7 operation.
Yeah, I mean, when you don't, you know, literally when some of the pipes and some of the main lines and some infrastructure dealing with is potentially 100 years old. Just to be able to keep that system functioning is, I'm glad it's not my job. It would be a big failure if it was my job.
Well, your job is to keep talk business and politics, at least part of your job, functioning, and we appreciate that. Talk to us next Friday.
Yes, sir.
All right. Michael Tilley is with Talk Business Politics. You can read about this and so much more at talkbusiness.net. And happy Valentine's Day once again, Michael.
Yep, you as well, sir.
Theater Squared presents Anne, the inspiring and hilarious story of Anne Richards, former governor of Texas, who is bigger than the state from which she hailed. Performances Tuesday through Sunday, February 19th through March 22nd, 777-7477 or theater2.org for tickets. Support for KUAF comes from Malco Theaters, with locations in Rogers, Springdale, Fort Smith, Van Buren, and the Fayetteville IMAX Theater. Malco Theaters offering birthday parties, special events, and group retreats for individuals and businesses. Malco.com for more. Walton Arts Center welcomes The Trox, February 27th at 7 p.m. This all-male ballet company became famous for their comedic rendition of Swan Lake and continue traveling the world performing ballet and modern dance on point and in tutus. WaltonArtsCenter.org or 443-5600 for tickets.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas Department of Health compiles data on communicable diseases in Arkansas. But how does the agency accurately track cases, for example, during the current influenza outbreak? Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
The Arkansas Department of Health monitors outbreaks of 13 communicable diseases, including hepatitis, measles, mumps, whooping cough, norovirus, commonly referred to as stomach flu, the new coronavirus, and the influenza virus. And during annual flu seasons, which peak midwinter, the Department of Health issues weekly influenza surveillance reports to clinicians across the state and to media, which the public can also access on the agency's website. Dr. Jennifer Dillahay, Medical Director for Immunizations Outbreak Response, reviews those reports prior to release.
So when we're talking about how widespread the flu is geographically, we move from no activity to to sporadic activity, which is a small number of laboratory-confirmed cases. And then there's local activity, where there's perhaps outbreaks in just one part of the state. Regional activity is outbreaks of flu in at least two, but less than half of the parts of the state that we look at. And then widespread is when at least half of the regions in the state are experiencing flu or influenza-like cases.
According to the latest Arkansas Department of Health report, influenza is now widespread in Arkansas.
We also look at the intensity of influenza illness through the U.S. Outpatient Influenza-like Illness Surveillance Network, or the ILINET. And that is volunteer healthcare providers around the states, and we have them in our state, who look at their total number of patients and compare that to the total number that they saw for influenza-like illness. And so that would be what we mean by intensity. So the geographic areas that are seeing flu, we're seeing a lot of it right now. The intensity is very high.
The Arkansas Department of Health operates a flu reporting portal for medical providers and facilities to register and report suspected and confirmed cases of influenza. The information enables the agency to gauge the totality of an outbreak statewide and by geographic location. And the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Influenza Surveillance Team collaborates with state, local, and territorial health departments, public health agencies, clinical labs, medical providers, clinics, and ERs to generate the most accurate picture of complex influenza outbreaks in the nation.
Most of our data comes from two different sources. We participate in CDC, which is the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They have different surveillance systems. We get data from clinical labs, so we look at where they're reporting and what age groups they're reporting. But we also take from them samples that we send to the CDC so they analyze what types of flu are circulating.
For example, currently in Arkansas, 49% of cases are influenza A, which tends to be more severe and spreads rapidly, and 51% are influenza B, which tends to be less severe and contagious. Since late September, 20,560 positive influenza tests have been documented in Arkansas and 46 influenza-related deaths.
And so we have providers around the state who voluntarily participate in this, and they report to us their total numbers of patients that they see each week and the total number that we're seeing that had influenza-like illness each week, so that we can look and see what proportion of the patients they're seeing have influenza-like illness above the baseline. And the baseline is usually about 2.4%. It can vary, but if it's above baseline, that means there's more activity than there is on a, say, during the summertime.
The Department of Health also reports the number of flu-impacted nursing homes and school absenteeism rates and closures.
The school districts are not required to report whether they closed or not. We do hear about those reports through our nurses out in the state that have contact with these school systems.
The Arkansas Department of Health warns that reported cases cited in weekly influenza reports reflect only a portion of the actual numbers of flu cases in Arkansas.
We do not gather information on the total number of cases of influenza in Arkansas. There's a number of reasons for that. One of them is that once the flu is widespread, additional information is not useful. Secondly, it's because not all patients with influenza go to the doctor to be diagnosed.
And Dillahay says it's not too late to get a flu shot, which takes 2 weeks to take effect.
Yes, I think that we will see high-intensity flu that is widespread in Arkansas for several weeks still. And I do encourage people to go ahead and get a flu shot if they haven't gotten one already, because the flu will continue to circulate for quite a while.
Delahaye says the public can track Arkansas's influenza outbreak at healthy.arkansas.gov and search for influenza. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
As the Northwest Arkansas region continues to grow, so do the number of cases that end up in court, which is why during the last legislative session, lawmakers approved an additional circuit court judge for both Washington and Benton counties, upping the number from 7 to 8 and from 6 to 7, respectively. Both of these new judges will be elected by voters this year, while existing circuit court judges are up for re-election. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek spoke with Janine Perry, a political science professor at the University of Arkansas and director of the Arkansas Poll, about circuit and district court judgeships and why voters play an important role in their selection.
I've seen the signs. I'm sure you've seen the signs. And I'm willing to bet that some of our listeners have also noticed the signs in people's yards for district court and circuit court judges. So what is the difference between the two? Because they have very different jurisdictions.
Yes. The thing that most people will see on their ballots most frequently is what Arkansas calls a circuit judge. And those circuit judges are basically the generic label across any state would be their trial court judges. They're the kind of most front-facing level of judiciary in any state, or really, of course, at the national level where they're called district courts, even though they're all trial courts. The nomenclature here is rough in a system as hyper-federated as the United States. But that's what most people will encounter. And we used to call them circuit judges and chancellors, and they were both serving at the trial court level, but we changed that in 2000. So that's what most people across most of the states, most of this state in election years, when you see circuit judge, it's just a trial court judge, which is what most of us are going to have, you know, significant interaction with in our lives if we have an interaction with the court system. If it's not a minor level thing, you know, sort of misdemeanors and maybe a property line dispute with a neighbor, you know, small claims court over a business contract gone bad. Those are all happening now in what we call a minor court level. That's the generic label. And technically now those have been, since we overhauled our judicial system in 2000, those are now what we call district judges. So I will say that for the circuit judges, the signs that people are seeing right now, I will add, they are still allowed specialties when they divide things up in their respective circuits. So there are some who specialize in juvenile justice, and those are the major cases that they take. There are others that specialize in criminal. There are others that specialize in administrative law, you know, sort of public agencies and regulations. So those specialties are good for judging and probably mostly for clients because they help judges develop expertise in really complex and important areas of the law. But they can add a layer of confusion to voters, because if they go to a forum at the library, or they're trying to read in the newspaper, you know, they're thinking, wait, who's running for circuit judge and who's running for juvenile judge? A juvenile judge is just a specialty inside the circuit court system, where there will be multiple ones. I hope that helps.
I think it does.
Probably people just need to see a chart on the office for the administrator of the courts, for the judicial department, right, the judicial branch of Arkansas. You can go there, and under sort of public information and who we are, you can find an organizational flowchart, and it's actually quite clean and comprehensible, and it'll show you the four levels and even, you know, sort of show you how those divisions are inside each level.
So these circuit court judges, where do they have jurisdiction?
They tend to be, or they're organized into circuits, and those circuits usually affect one county or multiple counties, depending on the size of the caseload, which, of course, is heavily tied to the size of the population. So, yes, they're organized into counties. But in more rural areas of Arkansas, which, of course, is a big swath of the state, you could have many counties all in one circuit.
And what about district judges? Is that sort of on a city level?
Yes. Traditionally, those minor courts. Again, in the nomenclature and the discipline, they would be called sometimes courts of limited jurisdiction or what are sometimes called boutique courts, which I think is really darling. It's sort of flip, but it's funny. Those were often situated inside cities, yes. There are a handful of those left that are sort of outside of the total restructuring that Arkansas did in 2000. That are still kind of city courts, but generally speaking, each county, we're very slowly moving toward each county having just one district court or one minor court. And, you know, there could be other offices, right, and other things that are happening, but we're trying to sort of move into that fourth layer, also being more consolidated and uniform across the state.
So unlike a lot of other races that will be happening this year, the judge races are one of the few that aren't partisan.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They aren't partisan. And that just means they don't have party labels, of course, attached to them. You don't run as a Democrat or as a Republican. And there's an interesting legacy with that. Most of us, to the degree we think about judicial selection, that's what we would generically call it, how a judge becomes a judge and who gets to decide that, who gets to hire them essentially. Most of the time, to the degree Americans of any age and in any region think about that, we think about the federal court system and we think about presidential appointment and Senate confirmation. And every now and then in the news media, we are supplied with very high profile examples of a Senate Judiciary Committee conducting hearings, you know, on the nominee. And that kind of reinforces people's understanding of judges. But the reality is the majority of judges in the United States operate in state court systems, and the majority of those judges actually are elected. There are many forms of election, and it used to be the case that partisan election was a fairly common form, and then nonpartisan election was another common form. And then there's a third form of election, which is called a retention election. And that happens in about not quite half the states, but fully half of the states use election. And then it's sort of divided between partisan election and nonpartisan election. Arkansas used partisan election for most of its history. And of course, that inevitably, given Arkansas's history, meant that they were largely Democrats with a capital D. But in 2000, we moved toward a thing that the lawyer community, the legal community, had wanted for a long time, which was toward nonpartisan elections. So we stripped those positions of their party labels.
And I guess in my mind, that would make sense, right? Because a judge's job is to be impartial and mm-hmm. to make mm-hmm. decisions based on the case before them. So I guess in my mind, that makes sense.
It does to almost everyone. And I, of course, experience undergraduate college students the most, in addition to just citizens out in the public and the legal community and judges themselves, you know, definitely are enamored of the idea of justice as quote unquote blind, as impartial, you know, the scales of justice figure, you know, always wears the blindfold. And so identifying yourself with one of the major political parties or the other certainly seems to fly in the face of that. I will add, however, that political scientists have done a lot of research and have, for our disputes and our discipline, quite aggressively challenged the legal community on this point, because the consequence of taking those party labels off is that it depresses voter turnout quite significantly because we've lost our cue, our heuristic, and so we don't really know what those judges are about. And we would argue the reality is, and the research has shown for decades, that judges actually are partial to a particular way of viewing the role of government, and they're partial to a particular way of viewing human behavior, just as members of the legislative and executive branches are. So we would argue that it's more intellectually honest, if not as romanticized, to for judges to signal to people in that very broad way that while the cases that come before them, they will certainly hear all the facts and the evidence and the argument, and they will look to the law first, that they do have a particular philosophy that is toward, say, a larger scope and scale for government intervention or against a larger scope and scale for government intervention. some of the other things that people argue about that is that when you take party labels off, the candidates also lose a main source of financial support and organizing. And so one of the things we know, because these 50 states with all their many ways of putting judges in positions give us a laboratory of democracy, what we know is that candidates in nonpartisan judge states tend to have higher socioeconomic status winners. You have to have more money in order to run a successful campaign, or you have to be connected to people with more money. For us, it's kind of a balancing act between your perception of those judges if they have party labels, and then maybe the realities of life in a republic where people can and will use more information to inform their choices.
So why would you encourage people to pay attention to these races and to think about the people that they're electing to these positions?
Because they make decisions that significantly affect people, often at a vulnerable place in their lives. Some of these judges, I mentioned that inside a typical circuit, that you will have judges assigned to particular specialties, although they can overlap. So one who specializes in family law is where many Americans will find themselves in a case of a divorce, of a custody dispute. And there are, of course, people then who may end up in probate court over wills and property distribution. So while most of us encounter those situations only a couple of times maybe in our lives, they're really significant to us. And it's always struck me as a pretty terrible irony, I suppose, a tragedy almost, that most of us don't pay attention to it until our family arrangements and or our economic futures hang in the balance of someone we don't know and who's barely accountable to the community.
And how long does a circuit court judge stay in office once he or she is elected?
The circuit court judges retained a 6-year term. Appellate court judges and state Supreme Court judges have 8-year terms. So they are longer terms of office than your legislative or executive figure, although they're not life appointment like a federal judicial position. But remember, once we took the party labels off, incumbency then really becomes an even more powerful force. You get to run with the label judge or justice next to your name. And we know through experiments in other states that can give you at least a 5-point bounce in the polls because there's no other information available in a nonpartisan election. So once they win, their offices are their terms of office are longer than most of us expect. And then in addition to that, it's very likely they'll be reelected in those election states.
And how many terms can judges?
There's no limit.
On judges. So they can, so 6-year term after 6-year term, potentially.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So we will see these judge candidates on the ballot in March, and then potentially some of them could end up being on the ballot in November.
Yes. And so when we reorganized all of that, we arranged it so that judges run with the partisan candidates in the typical spring primary election, even-numbered year. And then if there's a runoff, the need for a runoff, because a candidate doesn't get the majority, and, in one of these races we have a five-way contest, so mathematically that's more likely, then the runoff happens in November with the general election rather than running it, 2 weeks later. That's an interesting irony, too, that political scientists have done some really interesting research on, because 2020, of course, is a presidential year, and that attracts the highest number of voters, but it also means it tends to attract more inexperienced voters. So those inexperienced voters end up facing these nonpartisan judicial runoffs when they really just came out for the presidential contest. So that's where we get this heightened phenomenon of what we call voter fatigue or ballot roll-off, which means that, I tend to be one of the handful of people voting by the time you get to the end of the ballot, because for a lot of those less experienced voters, only presidential contests are interesting enough, and high profile enough to pull them in and motivate them to appear at the polls. They're confused by that, and they tend to just skip those races. So it really, if you think about turnout of eligible voters being maybe 55 to 58% of the electorate, by the time you get to those what we call down ballot positions, you might only have basically half of the eligible electorate actually deciding those races. And it really gives the legal community that knows a lot about those races quite a lot of power, or other, you know, newspaper readers, Arkansas politics professors, that kind of thing. And maybe that's okay if you all trust our judgment.
Well, thanks for speaking with us today and walking us through these election processes.
Sure. I did my best. Thanks for asking me.
That was Janine Perry, a political science professor at the University of Arkansas and director of the Arkansas Poll, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek. Like circuit court judges, district court judges go through a primary on March 3rd and, if necessary, to a runoff in November.
KUAF is supported by Arvest Bank, offering a range of financial services from checking accounts to loans, mortgages, and more. Arvest is member FDIC and equal housing lender. More available at arvest.com. Sona, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, continues its 65th season March 21st at Walton Arts Center. Sona musicians perform the season's third Masterworks concert, featuring Mozart's Clarinet Concerto and Beethoven's Symphony No. 3. Tickets at 443-5600 or sonamusic.org.
Happy Valentine's Day. With me is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Do you have your quiver and your bow and your arrow? Are
you
Cupid?
Oh, I do. Excellent. I am totally Cupid. We have an absolute bouquet of theater right now in Northwest Arkansas in the River Valley.
Mm-hmm.
For me, there is no better gift than a night of theater. So let's run through these again, and you can see if there's something that would suit your sweetheart. Into the Woods. Last weekend at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale.
Stephen Sondheim's score, fairy tale characters.
7:30 today and tomorrow, 3 o'clock on Sunday. It's the last weekend. Remember, it's 3 o'clock on Sunday. In the Book Of at University Theater at the Black Box on the at the Global Campus in downtown Fayetteville, inspired by the Bible's Book of Ruth.
And this is set up in a thrust configuration, so audience members are on three sides of the stage.
Cool.
Yeah, it's very cool.
And it is, of course, the question, how do you get to be an American and who deserves to be?
Written by John Walsh, who's the head of playwriting at the university.
At the university. Yeah. 7:30 today and tomorrow, 2 on Sunday, and again next weekend. Tickets are $20 for adults. What day was that? Wednesday morning. I had some folks come up from Fort Smith Little Theater to do a podcast. It was their first podcast ever. They had so much fun talking about season 73 and the season opening play, which is called The Glitter Girls. The director described it as Steel Magnolias meets Survivor. The premise is that the Sisters of the Gleam and Sparkle have a member who has announced she is ill, mm-hmm. and she wants to give away a whole bunch of her money. And they have to decide who gets it. And hilarity ensues. 7:30 today and tomorrow, 2 on Sunday, and again next weekend at Fort Smith Little Theater. Tickets are $12. There's the bargain of the century. The Royale wraps up this weekend at Theater Squared in Fayetteville, based on the life of Jack Johnson, the first African-American world heavyweight boxing champion. 7:30, and you loved it.
I did. I absolutely adored it.
7:30 Wednesday through Saturday, which would be today and Saturday, and 2 o'clock on Sunday, and that's the end. Tickets start at $10 for the 30 under 30. Arkansas Public Theater is doing Newsies.
This is the second weekend for that?
It is the second weekend. It was not a script I knew. I tried watching the Disney version and got a headache about 20 minutes into it. The play is fabulous. It is at 8 o'clock today and tomorrow and 2 o'clock on Sunday, and then again next weekend. Tickets start at $32. And then Once on This Island is at the Walton Arts Center, the touring production of the Tony Award winner for Best Revival of a Musical. 8 o'clock today, 2 and 8 tomorrow, and 2 on Sunday. Tickets for that start at $25. And there's ballet.
Oh, that's right. Cinderella?
Cinderella, one of the great love stories. It's new choreography by Ryan Nye, the artistic director of Northwest Arkansas Ballet Theater. 7:30 today and tomorrow. That's it. at Arend Arts Center at Bentonville High School. Tickets for that are $25. The Chocolate Lovers Festival is tomorrow in Eureka Springs from 10 to 3 at the Eureka Springs Community Center, a.k.a. the old high school.
Right.
At 44 Kings Highway, it's $12.50 to get in, and it's like a cookie walk or any of those things. You get a box.
And then you get samples and
go on. You can make yourself just really sick is what you can do. And then you can stay in town because you can't come back down the mountain after you've eaten all that chocolate and go to the Mardi Gras Light and Sound Parade at 6 o'clock.
Right. It's in the usual downtown route.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Black Light Ball afterward at 7 o'clock at Chelsea's Cafe. And tickets for that are $35 at reserveeureka.com.
All right. You got us covered for Valentine's.
You can't mess this up, guys.
You'll be back Sunday?
I will.
Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
That's pianist, composer, and founding member of the Pat Metheny Group, Lyle Mays. He passed away this last week. And I'm Robert Ginsberg. I'll feature him this week on Shades of Jazz. We'll also hear from Mulgrew Miller, Wayne Shorter, Chico Hamilton, and much more. Shades of Jazz, Friday night and Saturday morning, right here on KUAF.
Shades of Jazz, tonight at 10 on 91.3, tomorrow morning at 11 on KUAF3. As we heard earlier this week on Ozarks, there are ample opportunities to see live music this Valentine's Day weekend, including in Siloam Springs. Sarah Lothan will be on stage tonight at Creekside Tap Room. Earlier this year, she stopped by the Harold and Blanchcock News studio at KUAF to talk with Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis. While here, she also gave us a sampling of her music.
My name is Sarah Lothan. This is an original song called In My Dreams. Cool. I'll just get to it.
How can I keep myself up and awake? You usually work so late, but I bide my time in the early morning light while you're sleeping in the sun. Oh, it's not fun, it's not fun. I just wanna be by your side. Oh, but how can I when we're so off time? Off time, we're off time. It won't be long till I take off completely into my dream so sweetly. You come into my room sleeping next to me, but it's only in my dreams. Oh, how could I keep myself from falling asleep, honey, while you're gone, while you're gone, while you're gone. I guess I could write you a song. Oh, just before I take off completely into my dream so sweetly. You come into the room and I feel you sleeping next to me. Fate that we often only discover once it grows far too late. When we find we must part ways, oh, and go alone on our separate paths in the night, in the night. We take off completely.
That was very nice.
Thank you.
Your voice is incredible.
Thank you so much.
How long have you been singing and playing music?
Well, I've been singing since, you know, I mean, I could talk, I suppose. Yeah. Like, I would always sing in private. I was very shy about it growing up. In fact, like, the first choir concert that I ever sang in, I actually did facing, like, not the audience. I just, like, turned around and faced the wall behind us. I've been singing and playing guitar since I was about, like, 15. I started learning to do it at the same time. I started to want to make a career out of it around that time, so I started gigging right at 16, like, when I could drive, had a car, and then also bought myself a PA sound system so I could just, like, play anywhere. Mm-hmm. So,
was there any one thing that made you decide you wanted to do this with your life, to just pursue music?
Mm-hmm. I mean, at first, I was really interested in musicals and Broadway and things. So I kind of, like, got my toes wet singing in front of people solo, you know, doing musicals. And then, you know, I don't know, I kind of got into that community, which was, it was great. You know, I love the theater community and everybody in it is, like, so awesome. But I just felt a little bit trapped in what I could express, you know. So yeah. I felt like playing guitar and singing just kind of gave me some more freedom with my vocals and different styles. Kind of finding my own voice instead of trying to sound like a Broadway star, you know what I mean? But it really helped me with develop a lot of power kind of doing that. But, yeah.
Which you've been performing throughout Northwest Arkansas, through the River Valley for a few years now. What have you learned through that time of performing out in front of people?
I learned that community is so important. And, you know, just, like, reaching out and being fearless, something I still kind of struggle with that a little bit, kind of, like, approaching, you know, a venue or kind of, like, going in and being like, hey, I'm good enough to play here. You should definitely have me or something. You know, it's kind of hard to muster that courage. But, you know, just, like, meeting other artists and just, like, hearing their point of view kind of, you know, gives me more confidence and you know, getting to know everybody in the scene here in Northwest Arkansas, you know, it's a very special place. And everybody is very inviting and warm, and everyone wants to work together. Like, there's a huge community of people that want to collaborate here. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I find that part has been, you know, the most important thing that I've, you know, noticed. And also kind of having your own voice, not getting too distracted by other people's, you know, success or downfalls, or feeling like you are experiencing a downfall. Just, like, stay strong, believe in yourself.
Comparing yourself you know? To yourself rather than other people.
Yes, yes. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, you're your own worst critic, you know? Everyone's way too harsh on themselves.
Now, you mentioned earlier before we were on mic that Megan Loaf has a new album coming out soon, actually.
Yes.
Tell us about that process.
Our debut album is set to come out February 21st. We're going to be having a party at Riley's. It's going to be so great. We'll be playing, obviously, Megan Loaf is playing. Honey Shuffle will be joining us. And The Candid will also be opening up the show. So, yeah, I would invite everyone to come check out the music, you know. It'll be a really nice evening.
Well, you also mentioned that not only is this Megan Loaf's debut album, this is the first music you've actually officially put out. How does it feel to actually put something out that you have poured effort and love and soul into?
It just makes me really excited for the future. Like, you know, it's finally happening. I haven't put out anything. And so it's like we've already seen a lot of success without releasing any music. So I'm excited to see what comes of it, you know.
What's the process been like of putting this album together? Like, where have you recorded it at?
It's been slow. We've been doing it at home, just DIY. Our drummer, Tanner, is also a producer. He's got all of his own recording equipment. He's recorded three of his own albums, so you can find those on Spotify. But it's been quick. When we get together and do it, you know, it's like we're no longer in the creating the music phase. We're kind of in, like, we know what we're gonna do. We're just gonna, like, do it and just get it done so that it's done,
Yeah.
But it's been really fun, you know. The guys are super great, and they have a great energy, like, the whole time. So, yeah, it's just fun to hang out with them, honestly. Yeah. We just have a good time.
What else are you looking forward to in 2020?
Oh, my gosh. I'm looking forward to, I mean, oh, there's so much. I mean, we're going to be touring in the summer.
Mm.
We went on a tour last year, and we saw a lot of success. So right now I'm in the process of kind of planning that out, mapping out what route to take and all that stuff.
Have you got a general idea of where you're going to try to hit?
I think we're definitely going to try to go west a little bit to Texas. I'd really love to, like, hit, like, Houston and Austin, Oklahoma City, Tulsa. We've played there multiple times. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, kind of head up that way, maybe go north over to Missouri and then try and just, like, make a little circle.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what I want to do, is just kind of, like, head south down into Texas, come back up, go through Missouri, Kansas maybe. Yeah. Yeah. We've been kind of branching out little by little. Right. So,
well, where is the best place for people to find out more about your music?
The best place, honestly, I mean, I hate to say it because, I mean, it won't be that way forever. But, like, the best place is probably Facebook, because it's just easy for me to post stuff on there, upcoming shows and like, sharing things. Is like, it's a good medium for that type of thing. That or my website. My website always has updates about gigs and, yeah, I'm sure the album will be on my website as well.
All right. Well, Sarah, I think that's all the questions I have for you. Would you mind playing one more song to close us out?
Oh, my gosh. I would love to. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming in. It's been an absolute pleasure.
All right. This is a song called Work. It's a little slower.
If I handed you a hammer, would you kneel next to me? Oh, the nails are old and rusted, and the boards rot beneath our feet. The days are long and the pay is small, but the nights are short and sweet. But it's gonna take a bit of work. Oh, take a bit of work to make us feel whole, to fill in the hole. Take a bit of work. Ooh, take a bit of work to feel safe and sound. You must build from the ground. They gave this land, I carved up the earth and placed my flag. Oh, but the storms rolled in, a beating, and the ground shook beneath my feet. The walls are weak. For me to begin, but it's gonna take a bit of work. Oh, take a bit of work to make us feel whole. take a bit of work. Ooh, take a bit of work to feel safe and sound. You must build from the ground. Oh,
Sarah Lothan performing for Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis. She's on stage tonight at Creekside Tap Room in Siloam Springs. Next Friday, she and Megan Loaf will release their first CD with a show at Riley's on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. You can find out more about that show at the Facebook page for Megan Loaf.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The University of Arkansas Theater presents In the Book Of, now through February 23rd at the Global Campus Theater in Fayetteville. A contemporary reimagining of the biblical story of Ruth, the drama explores the challenges of immigration and strong women who fight for their country, hometowns, and the right to love. 575-4752 or uarkartstickets.com for tickets.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Alpena. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to the show included Jacqueline Froelich, Zuzanna Sitek, and Timothy Dennis. Timothy also mastered our show. Most Friday shows, like this one, benefit from the help of Becca Martin Brown from the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette and Michael Tilley from Talk Business and Politics, and we are grateful for their Friday help. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean, and there is much more information about him and his recordings at darylsean.com. I can tell you his most recent CD is titled Safe in Sound. Thanks so much for being with us. We will come back Sunday morning at 9 for the next edition of Weekend Ozarks at Large. Then we have another week of new daily shows beginning Monday. You can hear us noon and 7. You can find us at ozarksatlarge.com. Happy Valentine's Day. Have a great rest of your weekend.